right, sisters, brothers, comrades, thank you all so much for being here tonight. My name's Sean Orr. I'm very thankful to be following Hussam and Sarah with the conversation about the reality on the U.S.-Mexico border, the reality of to be Palestinian in diaspora, because it really sets the context for us of how we need to understand Venezuela today. Because for the past 200 years, the ruling class of our country has inflicted a brutality upon the entirety of Latin America. And from the moment the Monroe Doctrine was signed and put into place, there has been a struggle to break it and to free the people of this entire hemisphere from the domination of imperialism and capitalism. And in Venezuela, they don't see themselves as the Venezuelan struggle. They see themselves as just the latest front in this 200-year-long battle. And so that is the context that we have to also understand what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border, the struggle that has expanded as well to the Arab world, struggle that we are all a part of and that we are all going to help break one day soon. So the focus of my talk is going to be the FRSO delegation to Venezuela. I'm going to talk less about the history of the Bolivarian Revolution, although if there are specific questions you have, feel free to ask them at the end, and I'll do my best to answer them. But I'm going to focus more on our visit and what we bore witness to. The overview of the trip is that we went for two main purposes. We went to meet with people and to see the reality of Venezuela. We timed it to be there during May Day because we figured we're better to be in the world than in Caracas during May Day, you know? And so we went the last week of April, first week of May, and we went there to meet with people from the revolutionary parties of the country, so the PSUV, the United Socialist Party, Maduro's party, the Communist Party of Venezuela. We also met with members of the government, especially the Ministry of the Communes, which I'll talk about a little bit later, and we met with people in the social movements down there. We had intended to have our trip kind of cross the country a little bit, but because of the events that played out that week, we were in Caracas from day one until we left, but there was plenty to see and there was much more we could have seen in that city. So when we got there, you know, we arrived and we started to get our bearings, you know, being in a country amid revolution for the first time in my life was quite the incredible experience, you know. And so we're kind of a little head over heels, I guess, you know, just absorbing everything that we see from every stencil of graffiti made by some revolutionary kid somewhere to the most beautiful murals that they have all over Caracas. It is quite an exceptional sight, and it's a large city, too. Venezuela has about 30 million people living there. 7 million of them live in Caracas and in the surrounding area, so it's a metropolis, you know. It's quite interesting, too, because, you know, you hear a lot in the United States about the opposition, about the Venezuelan opposition, and you'll see images of demonstrations of the opposition in Caracas. In the past, they were quite large. Today, they've gone to a trickle, and I'll talk about that a little bit as well. And when I was on the ground in Caracas, for those of us who, you know, grew up in the United States in the cities, you know, I'm from Milwaukee originally. I just moved here a few months ago. And so all I've known my whole life is cities segregated by class, by ethnicity, by race. Caracas felt very similar, you know, but it was heightened up a notch, you know. The class struggle was sharp in that city, and it was divided between the working class side of the city and the eastern side, which was predominantly the upper middle class, the bourgeoisie, the folks that have their nice houses in Miami for the summertime. So it is quite a it's quite a sight to see, and it's a very familiar sight, but it's one where the vast majority, the working class, the masses, they've got the upper hand right now, and that was quite cool to see as well. So, you know, we go about our trip, you know, we're getting ready for May Day, and then on April 30th, we wake up to someone screaming in the streets outside of the apartment we were staying in. So we were staying at a friend's house, Miguel Angel. He's a professor, and he lives on the eastern side of the city. He lives in an opposition neighborhood. And it's not an opposition neighborhood because if you are a member of the opposition, you move to that neighborhood. It's an opposition neighborhood because that's where the upper middle class lives. That's where the professionals live. That's who this opposition is. So we heard a woman screaming in the streets, and she was screaming, "Libertad, libertad, libertad." And, you know, it was like 6 a.m., and we're like, okay, there's some evangelical walking up down the street saying something about something. I don't know. We didn't know what was going on. But we turned on the news, and that's when we saw footage of Juan Guaido hugging Leopoldo Lopez on a freeway overpass that they had shut down. And they were calling on their supporters to rise up in the streets, and they were calling on the military to defect, to join Guaido, and to storm the presidential palace. And so we obviously were not expecting this, but we were with very good coordinators, very good fixers, people who work with the Bolivar in government, who have, you know, we trust them with our lives, and they are sadly very used to these kinds of moments. You know, they've lived through the guarimbas, they've lived through the lynchings, they've lived through the street battles, and so we did not know what to expect. They were saying that they were going to storm a military base that happened to be half a mile from where we were staying, and they had every intent to do it. And so what we did was we laid low. We stayed away from the windows, and we listened to the news, and our coordinator, Dostor, Miguel Angel, we were staying with, they were just getting message after message on WhatsApp because the news was moving very fast, and the people of Venezuela are very well organized, and so they made sure the news got out to everyone what was really happening. And it wasn't too long after that Guaido made his call for an uprising that the vice president of Venezuela, Delcy Rodriguez, she went on the TV and she called on the workers of Caracas to march to Miraflores, to march to the presidential palace, because our revolution must be defended. We will not give an inch to any betrayers, traitors to our country, to any military invaders. We will not give one inch. You know, we waited for the morning, and we were expecting the roadblocks to be heard. We were expecting gunshots. I mean, we didn't know what was going to be happening, but things were quiet. It was dead quiet, and we were in the heart of the opposition stronghold, and it was dead quiet. And so at around 11 o'clock, we're like, all right, well, if we're going to go, we should go now, because it doesn't seem like anything's happening. So Dostor, our coordinator, told us, bring clothes, bring any medicine that you have, anything like that, because we don't know if we'll make it back here. You know, we don't know if we'll be able to get to this side of town again. The idea was that we were going to go to downtown, which is on the west side of the city where the workers live, and we're going to go to a housing conference there. So we all pile into our SUV, and off we go. And, you know, it was, we didn't know what to expect to see. We didn't know if there was going to be a roadblock along the way. We didn't know if people were going to try to ask us who we were, what we were doing there. You know, we were a bunch of white people in a neighborhood where they wouldn't be expecting us to be, and they would question us right away, who are you here with, you know? But to our pleasant surprise, we didn't see a single roadblock. We didn't see a single march through the streets. We didn't see any of the opposition goons out there burning tires and pulling people out of cars as they've done many times in the past. What we saw instead was about 20 people wearing very nice clothes, waving Venezuelan flags and holding up signs on the side of the street. And it was like, okay, that looks like a lot of the street protests that I'm familiar with. They're very docile and don't mean anyone any harm. So that's good to see, you know. So we get on the freeway and we go around the city because the military base is right between us and downtown, and we would have to go the other way to avoid what was happening there, because it turned out that a few hundred opposition members had crowded there and they had tried to storm the fence to seize tanks and to seize helicopters to attack the presidential palace. And so there was serious stuff happening there. But so we went the other way around. And the whole time we're listening to the radio, and on the radio we're hearing, you know, the uprising happened, quote-unquote, at 6 a.m. At 6:30, the call went out for people to come to Miraflores. By 9 o'clock, there were 50,000 people standing outside Miraflores to defend it. These were people who had no idea what was going to happen that day. They didn't know if the U.S. Air Force was about to fly overhead and start bombing, but they went there anyways. And they didn't have a single gun. All they had was their revolutionary will, and they went there. And so as we're going downtown, we're listening to the radio, and the radio is just people, person after person, getting interviewed outside Miraflores, just basically, you know, saying, like, we're here, we're not going anywhere, we're going to defend this revolution to the death, you know? We're seeing, you know, the police are getting information and they're going all over the place. And, you know, we're in the middle of it. And so we come around the side of downtown. We come in through a tunnel and we enter the center of the city. And the streets are packed with people in red walking in one direction. And the thing was, is that because a coup attempt was declared, the government did what I think any government would do when there was a coup attempt declared. They shut down the trains. They shut down the subway system and the buses. No public transit was running. But yet, tens of thousands of people wanted to get to the presidential palace, so they just walked. And they were all walking in one direction. They were marching to the presidential palace. So we went to the housing conference. It was going on like there was nothing happening in the world. They just kept on doing their thing. This revolution doesn't skip a beat for any of the attacks done against it. Of course, we were kind of over the idea of the housing conference by the time we got there. We wanted to go to the palace. We wanted to see what was happening, you know? So we stayed there for an hour, and then we went to the palace, and things were dying down by the time we got there, because by the time we got there, it was noon. Juan Guaido was running away to a Spanish embassy. Of the armed forces that he called on to betray Maduro, 100 officers showed up, 80 defected within the first couple of hours, the other 20 disappeared. They just went running. So by the time we got there, this wasn't a rally to defend a revolution in a country to the death. This was a party, and it was pretty fun. There was a lot of music, a lot of people dancing around. Every different, you know, there's some, this is stuff from May Day, but in the previous slide, in the previous few of the slides, you would see there would be this youth group was over here, and they were like in formation. They were like basically jumping up and down, doing a chant, and then you look over here, and there's another one doing the same thing. At one point, a motorizado crew came in, which are the motorcyclists, you know, and they just came roaring up, waving flags, and just, oh man, they were fun. It was an incredible environment. You know, and we were the only Americans there. There was news cameras, there was news crews from across the world, China, Russia, India, the BBC even was there. Not a single U.S. news source was at the presidential palace that day. Not a damn one. And yet they seemed to be talking about what was happening in Caracas nonstop. They weren't there. Not one of them. They were just following Guaido's Twitter account. So we being, we stand out in a crowd, you know, in Venezuela. And so folks came up to us and they were like, why are you here? So we talked to a lot of people and, you know, what we expressed most of all was the how ashamed we were of our fellow country people who work for CNN and MSNBC for not having the bravery to actually be here and see reality for what it is. And reality is that this country is on one side, and it's on the side of a revolution, and it's not with these bastards who just want to bring in the Marines to knock down their own doors. So we did that for a while. It was great. We loved it. Very exciting. We got hungry. It was hot. And so we went walking around downtown Caracas, like the historic center of the city. Schools got out because none of the schools, they never closed during this because they beat the revolution, or they beat the coup very quickly. All the shops were open. They're all kids walking around in their school uniforms, taking selfies, hanging out. It was so normal. It was, you forgot what had just happened. So that was the time that we took to call our loved ones and just be like, hey, things are good. Revolution, the coup's beat. The revolution won. You know, we're feeling great. So I actually talked to, I called my wife, I called my partner and was telling her all this. And she's saying, CNN is saying that there are tanks rolling through Caracas, that they're massacring people, that they're comparing it to Tiananmen Square. And I'm on the phone with her. I'm literally watching a bunch of 12-year-olds like taking selfies like next to a statue downtown. And it's like the U.S. media couldn't be telling a bigger lie if they tried. I mean, they weren't on this damn planet when they were talking about Venezuela that day. And they haven't been for what, a single goddamn day since Hugo Chavez was put into power on the backs of a popular movement. And that needs to be understood. every single thing that comes out of the mouth of Juan Guaido that's repeated like it is a testament from God on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC is not rooted in the reality of this country. The opposition has lost its popular support because who the hell would support a political movement whose only stated objective is to get the world's most monstrous military to invade and tear the country apart? Who would vote for them? Who would come out and support them if that's their only demand? They're not offering a political alternative to the Bolivarian Revolution. They don't have a list of demands or anything like that. All they have to offer is Trump's army. How is that going to appeal to a 30 million person country in Latin America? People who are the vast majority of whom are the descendants of the indigenous and the African slaves who were brought over here. How is a white supremacist-led army going to appeal to those people and win them the next election? It's not. And they're not winning elections anymore. They've been defeated by their own foolishness and by, frankly, their own poor opinion of people that don't look like myself. They don't look nice and white and, you know, nice and crisp and look like we belong in Marco Rubio's office, you know? I've got a lot of shade from these people, you know? You know, that was our experience on April 30th. And then the very next day was May Day. So we got to go to a very excited march of, we said it was 400,000 people. You couldn't see it. We couldn't count it. We couldn't see the beginning or the end of it. It was a 10-mile march through Caracas from a housing mission area to the presidential palace. We found out later the government said 1.5 million were marching in the streets of Caracas. And they were jubilant. You know, these were the workers. These were the trade unions. These were the communes, the communal councils. They were marching side by side with the government, you know. Like, there's photos. So this is the photos of the May Day march coming to the end. We didn't go the whole way. We just waited at the final spot to meet people. And, you know, you see 1,000 come, you see 500 come, and then suddenly this just massive wave of people came. And they were coming fast. Like, they were almost running, you know? And you see, like, all these people in red, they're just coming by, and, like, you know, some of them are holding their union banners and, like, just a ton of energy and very joyous, you know? And then as they were coming by, our friend's like, oh, right there's the labor minister, and over there's the education minister, and over, oh, there's the vice president, you know? The government was with the people. They weren't off in like some motorcade, you know, a coup attempt had just happened against these people. They weren't surrounded by bodyguards. They were surrounded by the workers. They were surrounded by their own people, you know, because they, you know, it reminds me of that famous phrase from the Chinese Revolution, the people will be our mountains, you know, and that's what it is in Venezuela. They know whose side they're on, and the people know whose side they're on. So we did the May Day thing. It was very cool. We went, and I'm just going to mention two other visits that we did while we were there. This is photos from the 23 de Enero barrio, January 23rd neighborhood. It's a revolutionary neighborhood for working class folks who are the most committed to the revolutionary struggle there. Because they have communal councils there, communal councils. It's the people themselves in the neighborhood who get to decide how their neighborhood is run. And there was sort of an old like public restroom that was run down, not used. The communal council there decided to, they voluntarily took it apart, and they built this park that would belong in Paris. I mean, just gorgeous lampposts and these statues and this beautiful mural. And what it was is, it's called the Manuel Marulanda Plaza. It's a plaza that the community dedicated to the Colombian revolutionary movement, to the peasants, to the campesinos, to the workers who had suffered for 50 years in one of the worst civil wars in the history of our hemisphere. What we didn't know until we got there is that in a country of 30 million people, 7 million of them, more than 7 million, are Colombian. First generation, second generation, or people that just come here. And these weren't immigrants coming looking for jobs. These were refugees who had fled the war. This barrio, they dedicated this plaza to their what they see as their fellow country people, the Colombians, you know. They consider anyone that's in this hemisphere that's not the oligarchy and it's not our ruling class, they consider them their countrymen, you know. That's why Chavez gave free oil to the South Bronx for so many years, you know. They see us all as one, you know. And for us, this this visit was our most emotional, you know. One of our good friends, she was kind of explaining to us the plaza and this idea that, you know, the community made something for the Colombian people that the Colombian people had no ability to make for themselves. They couldn't dedicate a plaza to the revolutionary struggle in Colombia. They'd be slaughtered for it. And as she's telling us this, her grandparents were Colombian refugees. And so she, you know, she breaks down. It's a hard thing for us to... You have to kind of leave this country, or you have to go just to the edge of it to see and to really understand there's just the total brutality that has been inflicted on so many people for so long. And of course they are they've had enough with it for centuries, and it's just here in Venezuela that the breakthrough is coming. So another visit that we did was we visited these housing missions, which for the past 8 years, The Venezuelan government has every hour built 29 high-quality free homes for Venezuelan families. As of this moment, 1 in 3 Venezuelans have been removed from the slums, from the poor shacks in the rural areas, and have been put into the kinds of apartment complexes that you would have to spend $1,700 a month to get in this neighborhood. You know, and I'm not joking. These are in Venezuela, in a country that the U.S. considers to be racked in poverty and just to be, you know, what was Trump's word? Whole country, you know. They had provided washing machines and dryers for every family unit. They had AC units built into every single one of these apartment buildings, into the single family homes that they constructed. And those 29 houses an hour, they didn't take a break during the attempted civil war in 2017. They didn't take a break when Trump was saying Marines were going to come across the border. They didn't take a break during the coup attempt. Every hour, they're building these homes. During this entire economic embargo and this blockade that the U.S. has erected across this country to strangle their people, they haven't skipped a beat. They're not going to beat them. They're not going to beat them. You know, this movement's going to win. And that was one of our biggest lessons from there, you know. We saw how solid and how firm this revolutionary movement was. And it is truly a popular movement, you know. This is a movement that has, for 20 years, has worked to create what was one of the most unequal societies in the world. By the time Chavez was elected in 1998, 70% of Venezuelans lived below the global poverty rate. Think about that the next time NPR says that this used to be the richest country in Latin America. Who was it rich for? It wasn't rich for the vast majority of Venezuelans. That's why they kicked that out of those corrupt politicians in that election and every national election since then. In the past 20 years, 25 national elections have happened in that country. Every single one of them internationally observed. Every single one of them audited to an extent that ours are not audited at all. What's our audit process? Was it like 5%, 10% vote? Their minimum is 30% of any vote, and they do it automatically. And then they do it a second time. In 2013, when Maduro won by a percentage and a half, they audited 100% twice. That would never happen in this country. And in these 20 years, these 25 national elections have been carried out, and the Venezuelan revolutionary movement has won 23 of them. 23. There is no more popular democratic movement that I can think of in this hemisphere, you know? I mean, you can't beat it, and that's why they haven't been beaten yet. So, just to give a hard numbers example of this level of organization, this level of unity of the movement. On May Day, President Maduro, he was the big speaker at the May Day March, of course. They call him El Presidente Obrero, the worker president, because he's a worker, you know, and they have a lot of pride in that. And he called for, you know, he's like, we beat the coup attempt, but we need to move forward. You know, we are always on the defensive, but we just need to be on the permanent advance. We have a goal. Our goal is socialism. We can't skip a moment in the march towards that. And so he called for a rectification of the revolutionary movement. He called on the masses to come forward, to bring forward their criticisms of the movement, of the government, and to come forward with their own proposals on what we need to do to build this new society that they're in the process of creating. And he called for this on Wednesday, on May Day. And by that weekend, they had created two nationwide gatherings. One was by the PSUV, the governing party, and the other was by this group called the Bolivarian People's Congress, which is sort of a congress of the social forces of the revolution, the communal councils, the communes, and the social movements. For the PSUV, in the 3 days from Maduro's speech, they brought together delegates from over 13,000 units of their party and 32,000 local supplies and provisions committees, the CLAP. The CLAP is a grassroots movement that was started to beat the economic war. The economic war in Venezuela is fought on the grocery shelves. It's fought over the cost of food, which are still in the hands of the capitalists. And the CLAP were created by the communal councils, by the people's militias, and by the PSUV coming together in every neighborhood and providing free food to every family that needs it. And by doing that, they have avoided the mass starvation that the United States wanted to inflict on Venezuela, and they've been doing that for about 5 years now. So the PSUV brought together 13,000 units of their party and 32,000 representatives of the CLAP, and in their national assemblies that they have had all over the country that weekend, over 800 proposals came together to go to Maduro's desk. And the People's Congress, the Bolivarian People's Congress, they brought together in that same time span delegates from, and I have exact numbers for this, 47,896 communal councils. Those are things that are actively being participated in by hundreds of thousands of families every week around the country. Almost 48,000 communal councils, 3,094 communes. Communes are a grouping of communal councils and what they call social property enterprises, socially owned, worker-owned enterprises, companies whose job it is to provide for whatever is the immediate need of the community there. So over 3,000 communes and 56 social movements. They submitted over 21,000 proposals to the Venezuelan government. Every single one of them is being read. They're assessing everything. They're pulling things together into a nice little presentation that they're going to give later on. But this is how organized they are. That you can't beat that with Juan Guaido and Leopoldo Lopez getting 20 soldiers to stick by their side for more than 2 hours. They're not going to beat that. And the U.S. isn't going to beat that. You know, the U.S. learned a pretty hard lesson in Vietnam. You can't defeat an organized nation. You can't defeat an organized people. They'll fight on. They'll beat you in the very end. And I guess the Venezuelans need to teach Trump this lesson for himself. Maybe they're a little short-sighted and forgot the great lesson the Vietnamese handed to them so not so long ago. So I'm going to wrap this up just with a quote that I got from the PSUV. They hand out like a bulletin, and I was reading it, and they ended it with this quote from Simón Bolívar. Simón Bolívar he's the founding father of Venezuela, and we can't grasp how significant he is to the Venezuelan nation. Even to the right wing, they hold Bolívar in such regard because, you know, this was an aristocrat who betrayed the aristocracy. And he led an army of peasants and freed slaves. And they marched from Caracas through Venezuela, through Colombia, through Ecuador, across the highest mountains in this hemisphere, into Peru. And in a matter of 10 years, they broke the back of the Spanish Empire. They defeated the largest empire the world had ever known. And this was a poor people's army. And along the way, they freed every slave they came across. This was in the 1810s. This was 50 years before our Civil War. This was 80 years before slavery ended in Cuba and Brazil. And they freed every slave they came across. He is their light in Venezuela. They hold him as their idyllic figure. You know, that's why they call themselves the Bolivarian Revolution, because they think that Bolivar's work is not done yet. Because Bolivar knew that as soon as the Spanish Empire fell, the U.S. would step in to fill their place. He knew that. He predicted that. He said that the peoples of our America, not the United States of America. That's an idea that belongs just to the rich of this country. But the peoples of our America, which is every oppressed person from Alaska to Chile, their dreams, their desires can never be fulfilled until the U.S. empire is broken. And that's where the Venezuelan movement is at. And they still look back to Bolivar. And so they ended this party document, this party bulletin to their members with this call from Bolivar to his own soldiers as they marched into battle against the Spanish. And they put it here because this is the call that they put out to their people today, because it still rings true. And I'm just going to read it for you all. It's very short. Soldiers, you go to complete the greatest task that heaven has entrusted to mankind, that of saving the entire earth from slavery. All of America awaits from you peace, the daughter of victory. You are invincible. So, thank you all so much.
You mentioned those clappos, I think you call them.
The clap, yes.
I saw a report recently that Trump had planned to sanction those. Mm-hmm. Can you shed any light on that? What the practicalities of that are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely can. Thank you for asking that, actually. It matters a lot. Venezuela was really, they were set up with a pretty faulty system they were handed when Chavez took power. Their entire economy was built around one purpose over their past 100 years, and that was to export oil to Texas. That was it. They never created their own agricultural base was abandoned. All of their own internal industries were abandoned, and a little group of people just got very rich off of sending the world's largest oil supplies to the United States. And so for so long, Venezuela has been the only net importer of food in the entire hemisphere. They don't grow food in their own country to feed themselves. They would just import it cheap from the United States with the money that they got for selling oil to the United States. And so what happened was, because, you know, and this is for the U.S. ignores this news as well, the news ignores this as well. The United States was the major trading partner for Venezuela for so long until essentially, until Obama started the sanctions, basically. It was their main trading partner. They relied on the United States for their food to feed their population. That wasn't the decision of Chavez and Maduro. That was the decision of all of their predecessors who were comfortable with that because it lined their pockets. And so they created the CLAP with food that was mainly imported. Now, for the past 20 years, they have worked to develop their own agricultural system, to grow their own corn, their own rice, the basic necessities to keep people, you know, alive and to keep people fed. But it's really hard to turn an entire ship like that, this economy that's been going in one direction only for so long, for them to pivot into this diversified economy. It takes decades, and they started 20 years ago, and it's ongoing. So the CLAP boxes, which provide these families with all the food they need for 2 weeks, most of that food's imported as well. A decent amount of it still comes from the United States, but a larger part of it comes from Europe, comes from Mexico, comes from other countries in Latin America. And Trump has said this week that the U.S.'s next round of sanctions will probably be to target any agricultural companies that export food to Venezuela. This is the same U.S. government that is saying that the Venezuelan people are starving. They're eating garbage out of the garbage cans, you know. They want a genocide in that country. When Trump made that announcement, the Venezuelan movement did what they do best, and they had a march about it. They organized hundreds of thousands of people to march through the streets of Caracas with their clap boxes over their head, basically saying, like, we're going to defend our food. We're going to defend this grassroots initiative that has saved our own lives. We're going to look for alternatives, you know. I think that they're probably going to expect a good trade deal with China, with Russia, with other pretty large food growers in the world to help make up for the difference. That's the nice thing right now. The U.S. empire is falling apart. They don't have the global hegemony they had even 10 years ago, and there's countries that are just no longer willing to go along. But we'll see. I mean, even if China sends in food to replace the U.S. imports and the other companies that are too afraid of the United States to stand up to them, it's going to hurt. It's going to really hurt this country, and I can't predict what could happen from that, but, you know, it's genocidal.
Sorry, 1 second. I forgot to do something. My apologies. So we have 4 members of the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, here who are going on a delegation to Venezuela, and I was supposed to do a fundraising for Pitch for Them.
Yes.
I forgot. I was too excited.
Let's do it.
So we have 4 members of the Chicago Teachers Union who are planning on going to Venezuela and meeting with the Teachers Union in Venezuela. So they need to fundraise to meet their costs. The union is not paying for them to go there. So we're going to have someone come around with a hat, a box, a cigar box.
Have them stand up.
Oh, yeah. If you're going on a delegation, please stand up. Thank you so much. So, Joe, please go around with that box. And if you can...
Get it first.
Awesome.
So, yeah. So, if you don't have cash right now, if you have cash, give cash. And we'll also post a link inside the Facebook event. So you can share that link and get more people to be able to donate.
In the corporate media, that's the common criticism that you hear of the Chavez regime and the Maduro administration, is that they have not diversified their economy.
Right, right.
Can you give us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I definitely can. One thing is, the sheer scope of it, the way we understand an economy to work is not how Venezuela's economy was set up to work. It was literally not just 90% of their exports were oil. Almost 100% of their state's income, they didn't collect taxes from people. They just got the money from the oil deals. That's how they funded their entire government. You know, it wasn't just the economy was built around oil. The state was built around oil. The society, the culture, everything. So it takes a long time to diversify from a single thing. But it was also, for the first few years of the Chavez administration, their immediate goal was not economic diversification. You know, the oil market was on the uptick, oil was becoming more expensive, OPEC had just kind of reformed themselves and were establishing quotas for production. That was also the context that the U.S. went and marched into Baghdad around. But it wasn't on their immediate mind. What their immediate mind was to build social equality in Venezuela. So they did what had never happened before in Venezuelan history. They took the money from the oil that they were still selling abroad, and they put it towards building health clinics, to providing free quality education through university, to curing tens of thousands of people of blindness, to creating new dental schools, to establishing these housing missions. They put it into raising up the living standards of the people. That was Chavez's main focus until roughly about 2006. Those are the misiones, the missions that you hear a lot about, the Bolivarian missions. That was their main focus for about the first 6-7 years. After that, that's when they started to think about the diversification of the economy, and they established a new mission, basically kind of like a back-to-the-land movement to encourage people to go establish urban farms, rural farms, cooperative farms, all that kind of stuff. It's a long process. You know, their economy is not a planned economy. It's not the Soviet Union. It's not China before the reforms. It's not any of the socialism that we've seen. It's still a capitalist economy. Even today, at this very moment, only about 1/3 of the economy is run by the workers or the state. The other 2/3 is still run by private owners, by private capitalists. They can do as much as they can with the 1/3 that's the popularly run economy, but there's still 2/3 of these capitalists that they have to persuade to do what they need to do, you know? And they can only do so much. It's a hard struggle. I mean, they didn't get the capitalists to invest in any new industries. They weren't interested in that. They were just interested in continuing to get oil money so they could buy imports and get their nice shiny new cars and do all that good stuff. The workers, through their communes, they started to establish agricultural enterprises. There's now this massive corn complex. It's like tens of thousands of people grow and process corn, and it's called El Maizal, La Comuna El Maizal in the state of Lara, and they produce products, and they fill the clap boxes with those goods. It's not enough, you know? The Venezuelan governments of Chavez and Maduro have done everything that they can within their power and with the power of this movement to diversify the economy. It's the capitalists that have decided not to diversify. It's funny. I mean, they call their bourgeoisie, they call them the non-productive ones. They're called the lazy ones in Venezuela because they really do shit, you know? They just kind of sit around and they collect their checks from the oil dividends and from It's funny, you know, this is neither here nor there, but, you know, you hear a lot in Latin America about remesas, remittances, you know. It's how a lot of, especially poorer families in rural El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, it's how they get money. They get it from their family members that live in the United States. They send a little portion home to help out. Remesas are a big part of the Venezuelan economy, but they're a big part of the economy for the middle class and for the rich, because a lot of wealthy Venezuelans live in the United States now, and they send money back home. So they're not... They're not playing game. They're not playing along. The fact that the Venezuelan economy is not diversified is the fault of the capitalists that had for decades total control of that country and did nothing about it. It's a fault of the 2/3 of the economy that's not interested in helping out the Venezuelan nation right now. So he asked, you know, like the U.S. media is always talking about how Maduro is leading to starvation in Venezuela. There's people starving in the streets, eating stuff out of the trash, you know. He asked if we saw people starving, you know. Just to say again, we only were in Caracas, so I can't speak for the entire of the country, you know. It is hard times right now, you know. I mean, all of the food in Venezuela is sold by essentially one single privately owned monopoly called Polar. The owner lives in Florida. He doesn't adhere to any price regulations at all. So they put, like, when we went to a grocery store, it was more expensive than me going to Jewel-Osco with the exact same amount of money, you know, to buy the exact same things. And in Venezuela, the minimum wage to live is six US dollars a day. So it would cost $7 to buy a little packet of cold cut. That's how bad the Venezuelan bourgeoisie has made it for their own people. And so the clap boxes provide eggs, they provide bread, pasta, rice, milk, yogurt, and some fruit. That's it. And sometimes they get some meat in there. They have this special program where every Christmas, the Venezuelan government and the movement distributes like a turkey to every family in the country, so that way they can continue their traditions. But it is harder times. So we didn't see any starvation. People said that a lot of folks have lost weight because they're not eating as much meat as they used to. They're not eating as much like junk food because you can't buy it. You wouldn't buy it. You wouldn't waste your money on it. We saw a couple of food lines, but it was lines outside of like popular bakeries to get like the latest bread that was made and stuff. So it was no different than the line I would see for brunch anywhere in my neighborhood on a Sunday, you know. It's not at all what the U.S. media has portrayed as. There's no mass starvation in that country. There's no reported instances of it. In the past 4 years, though, the Venezuelan government estimates that about 40,000 people have died as a result of the U.S. sanctions and the blockade of the country. A lot of those are people who were waiting for organ transplants from the United States, and they didn't get them anymore because the transplants weren't allowed to send them to Venezuela. They actually, a 2-year-old just died from that pretty recently. But that's the reality down there. The deaths that are happening because of this economic war are on Obama and Trump's hands, and they're not on the movement's hands down there. But we'll see what happens with what, you know, these attacks on the food program. Hopefully it doesn't lead to that, but you don't know. You don't know. So thank you, though, for asking that. Thank you. All right, so the question was, you know, who is siding with the United States against Venezuela? Who is, you know, like Mexico not choosing to take a side, and who is standing with Venezuela, especially in the West? Right now, there are two main governments that are supporting Trump. It is the government of Colombia, which is led by Iván Duque. He is a far right-winger who comes out of the same political movement that gave birth to the death squads that killed so many people in the 90s and in the 2000s with Uribe. And then the other one is the government of Brazil, led by Jair Bolsonaro, we've all heard about Bolsonaro. He's a nut job. So that's like the main alliance right now. It also happens to be the two main countries that border Venezuela. So Colombia and Brazil both have about 5,000-10,000 troops that are just permanently stationed now on their sides of the Venezuelan border, ready to do whatever the Pentagon asks them to do. So that's sort of the main alliance right there. Also, there's a lot of other right-wing governments in Latin America that have taken power who are, to a lesser degree, supporting the effort, but they've all said, we do not support military invasion. We think it's a bad idea for the U.S. to put troops on the ground in this hemisphere. Then you have Mexico and Uruguay, who are both very important countries diplomatically in Latin America. They have both said they respect the right of self-determination of Venezuela, and Venezuela should figure out Venezuela's own issues. For Mexico to do that, that's a huge deal that hasn't happened for decades, where the Mexican president has actually broken ranks with the United States. And so everyone's very thankful of AMLO for being willing to take that. I mean, it's a brave stand, you know? I mean, they depend, we just saw that with this threat of tariffs, you know, Mexico depends a lot on the U.S. economy because of imperialism, and so he took a very brave stand with that decision. In terms of who backs Venezuela in the West, nobody right now. Spain, the Spanish prime minister, actually, when Guaido declared that he was now the president of the country, Spain said they would not recognize Guaido. The next day, Mike Pence went to Spain. And there were Spanish members of the government who reported this on, like, the news afterwards. He went to the prime minister and said, you can't do that. You have to follow rank on this. Otherwise, you know, we're going to start looking really unkindly at Spain. So that day, Spain put out a thing recognizing Juan Guaido. Obviously, in the UK, the UK Labour Party is led by someone who is a very vocal supporter of the Bolivarian Revolution. So hopefully he wins their next election and they can really mess up imperialism at that point. But beyond that, Venezuela really relies on two main allies right now, China and for the economy and for commerce and for finance, and Russia for military and the economy as well. He's not Putin's puppet, you know. I know they said that about Maduro. He's just not. That's not what this is. Like with the economy, Venezuela's military got their guns and ammo and uniforms and training and tanks and everything from one place, the United States, for a very long time. And in 2006, Bush cut them off. If you, in this world today, if you don't get weapons from the United States, there's really only one other place you can go to. That's Russia. And so that's why they have a military alliance with Russia. It's as simple as that. With China, China has now become the single largest provider of credit to Venezuela. They've overtaken the United States. They have also erased all of their debt to China. They have sent over 200 tons of medicine to Venezuela for free. This is stuff that the U.S. used to send them. That's another part of the 40,000 deaths. The Venezuelan people don't get insulin anymore. Insulin's really just made in the United States, and diabetics are dying from that. So China's working on sending their version of insulin over there as well right now. So these aren't the big bad Xi Jinping and Putin who are puppeteering Maduro. These are just the governments that believe the world is not the dominion of a single empire. It's not the dominion of a single nation. It's the dominion of all of us, of the entire peoples of this planet. And they just want to build a multipolar world, you know, and that's where Venezuela sees themselves fitting in. They're not looking at doing any, you know, any harm to anybody in this world. They just want to live in peace, you know. And China and Russia support peace. Trump, Bolsonaro, Duque, do not. They want the slaves back in chains that Bolivar freed so long ago. They're not going back. So.